Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Gary Heseltine. Gary has come out with a new book, Non-Human: The Rendlesham Forest UFO Incidents, 42 Years of Denial. And I've had Gary on the show before, retired police detective, a longtime veteran UFO researcher who's delved deeply into Rendlesham Forest, as well as many other cases. So, without any further ado, Gary, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me as a guest.
You got your book over the finish line. Tell us what that was like. It was 5 years in the making.
It was, and I. It's a book I never intended to write. As you know, I'm the editor of an e-zine, a UFO Truth magazine, and that takes a lot of time up. But obviously, about to September 2007. I'd been doing a lot of private research regarding Rendlesham anyway, but I was then asked to get involved in a documentary called Capel Green, which they asked me to get involved as a lead researcher. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do this and put my name to it, I best, do a reinvestigation because it has to be totally accurate from my point of view as a former detective. And that's what I did. And so I went away and then began to really delve down everything I could find, whether it was old documents, online interviews. To then trying to re-interview several of the military witnesses along the way, and that's basically what I did. And it took 5 years on and off. I'm not working on it every day, but basically 5 years of that process. And in that time, I probably did something like 20 re-interviews of people. Got a new witness to come out of the woodwork late on in 2021, who was not a US security police officer, what's called as a crew chief. He was a technician who repaired aircraft, jet aircraft. So he came out with an excellent case. And there is an update on that, which we can talk about later. But yeah, it was just the book took 3 years to write, and it's my first book. Obviously, doing a magazine is great, but that's in a sense an e-zine. It's not in print, and it's not tangible in physical proof, as it were, something you can hold in your hand. And a lot of people said, "Oh, are you going to bring it out as a Kindle version?" And I said, "No, not initially, because I really just want people to hold the book in their hands." And I guess I'm old-fashioned and still like to hold a book in my hand, like a lot of people. And so it's only available in paperback, and I did that deliberately. I spent the closer you get to the end, the harder you work because it's like tantalizingly close, and you're working 12, 13-hour days, and you're proofing it, and you're sending it out for people to review and things like that. So it was a mad time this last couple of months, but I finally got it out there. But what I've done is I'd, because the Rendlesham Forest case is so complicated, which a lot of people don't realize, but it has so many moving parts, and there is really a lot of disinformation out there, which, caused by a variety of reasons, not least some of the witnesses have caused, I think, some disinformation, that it's complicated. And so what I wanted to do is have no pre-publicity whatsoever. Only a few people really knew I was writing a book. I talked about it, on the odd show, but not given any dates or anything because I didn't want to commit to anything. And then literally I'd made the decision. From my point of view, if you think you've got a book that contains a lot of new material that people would like to read that they've never probably read before, I wanted to just slip it out there quietly under the radar so it's out there. Because once it's out there, you can't take the genie out, you put the genie back in the bottle. And so I was conscious of that. So I deliberately did no pre-publicity whatsoever and then put it out. And that was, as I say, a deliberate ploy to get the truth out there. And that's really what I want to do. And one of the primary reasons for writing the book was I came to realize over the many years of my research, I've been researching the case publicly since 2007, when I first met Colonel Holt and had a 7-year collaboration period with him. One of the things that I was conscious of was that there is just so much information. There is a lot of infighting that there's been. And I literally just thought, if I do write a book, I'm just going to slip it out there. And then the truth is out there, and then people can make of it what they will. I want to reach as wider audience as possible because I think there's a lot of old information that you should have known about that's never been put in any documentary. And there's a lot of new information, especially from two or three military witnesses that I've re-interviewed, and I've gained some amazing new testimony, which I think adds to the case greatly. So it's a combination of all of those things, but it was a deliberate ploy to just slip it out there, and then that's the genie out of the bottle. It's a bit like, as a comparison, that the game changer for where we are now with moving towards a disclosure program, I think, or that's maybe underway, depends on your point of view, but was when the three US Navy pilot videos were released and then authenticated, it was a done deal. And it's the videos that make the difference now, because people for the first time could look at those videos, and the press could look at them and go to politicians and military people and go, "What is that on the screen?" And they didn't have an answer. And that was the game changer. So for me, it's about getting the truth out there, and then you can start the publicity, and that's what I'm doing now. I'm just trying to raise interest in the case, and I'm grateful for people like you for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Many of us are students of the Rendlesham Forest cases, because in truth, as you know, there's been a number, a series of incidents over a prolonged period of time. Can you bring our listeners not only up to date where they should have been had not all this interference and disruption taken place, and also roll out some, however much you're willing to share, about some of your new sources and your new cases? Because Rendlesham is ever evolving. It's not a static, monolithic block. Like you said, there's a lot of moving parts to it, and everything, it encapsulates so many different things, the nuclear angle, et cetera, et cetera. So bring our listeners up to the present and then going forward with the book.
Okay, that's easier said than done. But as best I can, I think I looked at the, in writing the book, I looked at where we were with the case in terms of what was generally accepted prior to my reinvestigation of the case. So prior to 2017, and then in a sense, post 2017, with everything I'd accomplished during the reinvestigation period. And by the end of the reinvestigation period, I'd come to realize that the narrative, in my opinion, and that's all it is, in my opinion, the narrative of the Rendlesham Forest case has probably been controlled for 25 years, carefully controlled deliberately by certain people. And in my opinion, it's been controlled by principally just four people, and that is Colonel Holt, Jim Penniston, and John Burroughs, along with Nick Pope, who's had a very strange association with the case right from his inception, when he burst on the scene in 1996. He's had a very close tie and has become the media go-to guy for the world. And he has been in a uniquely privileged position to kind of like dominate the case in terms of the public narrative. But ultimately, my reinvestigation was really about trying to give a voice to all the other witnesses who were effectively not being given a voice. I mean, yes, a lot of people have been referred to, interviewed. Georgina Bruni did a very good book, You Can't Tell the People, in 2000. That's probably arguably the best book, so far on the case overall, but that was 20 years after the event. And she'd interviewed, got new interviews from people, approached people, and got interviews that had never gone on the record. But seemingly, many of these interviews are not really seen anywhere else. Very rarely are people interviewed. They might be on a TV documentary for the odd minute or so. But the case is effectively in every, there's been about 50 odd mainstream TV documentaries done by many countries over the years. But in the English speaking world, probably 50 plus in the English speaking world. And they generally feature those four people or a combination of. And very few people seem to get a look in. And that doesn't strike me as being fair to the others. And when you talk to the others, as I have done, there are some people that I've tried to get an approach to be re-interviewed, and people have gone through to them as an intermediary on my behalf, and they'll say, "No, nothing against Gary, but I don't like the way the case is presented in the narrative as it is." So I kind of went into this thinking, I want to try to get a wider vote, a wider, I'll change the narrative and allow other people to really have much more of a say. Hence why I've gone back to people I thought may have more information. And they did. And in some cases, there were new witnesses, a guy called Steve Longero, who came out of the woodwork, I think 2018, 19, who just approached me and said, "I'm so fed up with all the way the bickering is, and especially in relation to the original military whistleblower, Larry Warren." He said, "I've got a story to tell." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And over the course of a number of interviews, we ended up producing what's called like a statement, a confirmation statement, bear in mind my policing background. And it was establishing what his story was. And then I would say, "Right, this is what we've come up with. I'm going to send it to you. If you're happy with it, sign it. If not, you want to make some alterations or whatever." Very similar to a statement taking process, but obviously different parts of the world. So you do it in a slightly different way. But in essence, we produced a statement based on his account, what he told me. And his account is probably a good place to start because it contains a number of things that we kind of knew about but have not been confirmed. For example, there'd been lots of speculation about whether a UFO had shone a beam down into the nuclear bunkers. And it had been speculated, Colonel Holt had said various things, other people had said various things, but there wasn't a name to it. There wasn't a direct first-person testimony witness. And then with Steve Longero, he amazingly said, "I was in the nuclear weapons storage area when that event happened." Wow. Tell me more. So he basically said he'd not been on shift only a few, he'd just arrived at the base and only been on shift for a few literally probably less than 5 or 6 shifts when this incident all kicked off. And he said because he was so new, he was shadowed by an experienced airman or possibly a sergeant, but I think it's probably an airman. So he was walking around on patrol with his M16 inside the nuclear weapon storage area at RAF Bentwaters, and can't be certain of the date, but on one of the nights of activity, and we know that there's at least three, and I now believe it's probably four consecutive nights of UFO activity, hence why it's complicated, and hence why there's a lot of people involved. And he's walking around with an experienced airman, and then suddenly they, not just him, they see a UFO near to the outer perimeter of the weapon storage area, which has a twin outer fence perimeter. It's the most secure place on either bases, Bentwaters and Woodbridge. It has an outer fence and an inner fence, electrified motion detectors, that kind of thing, because you're guarding nuclear weapons. So I know this because I worked on two nuclear weapons storage areas myself during my 6 year service in the Royal Air Force between 1983 and 1989. So I've had a unique insight. I did pretty much the same job as they did. So I kind of knew how it worked. And he's walking around and they see a UFO over the forest near to the outer perimeter of the twin ringed weapon storage area fence, like just a normal see-through fence. And it shone a beam down into the bunkers, but it didn't just shine a beam down into one bunker. It proceeded to almost, he described it as like a pendulum motion, where the beam was effectively looked like it was scanning. So it was going from one side to the other, one side, and then it was moving down further away, down what was considered, if you've ever seen the photographs, the hot row of RAF Bentwaters, which contained underground tactical nuclear weapons. Okay, so he scans and he describes it as being basically like like it was conducting a scan of the contents of what was in that nuclear weapon storage area. Then the beam goes off. At the same time, by the way, and this is what's always been denied, and certainly Colonel Holt had said, "Well, if there'd been something like that confirmed, there would have been alarms and whatever." Well, according to Steve Longero, who was inside, all the alarms did come on and all the lights did come on. So, and people started reacting and deploying to various set bunkers, protective, what we would call in the RAF sangers, but a little protective gun emplacements, shall we say, where you would have sandbags and you've got a position to shoot if you were under attack. So people were deploying. He's reluctant to really talk about the level of commotion, but he says the alarms came on, as you'd expect if something was doing something like that. So this was not a little event. This was a major panic stations moment, according to Steve Longero. And let me put this into context. Why would Steve Longero lie? I don't. He went on to have a 30-year collective career in law enforcement. He was a sheriff and that kind of thing. So he had a his time in the Air Force, and then he went on to have a very long career. He's now retired from law enforcement. So this is a very stand-up guy, and I actually met him when I brought him over to my UFO Truth conference in 2018. And it was a privilege to meet him, real stand-up guy. So he said that, but this is where it gets interesting. So not only now do we have confirmation that from a named witness, a direct first-person witness, that beams were into the nuclear weapon storage area, he then said something that took me by surprise. He said, and after the beam went off and all the alarms are sounding and everything's okay as people scurrying around, as you'd imagine in those circumstances, because he was so new on shift and because he was effectively supernumerary, the UFO was seen to head towards Rendlesham Forest after it left the weapon storage area at Bentwaters. And he heard on the radio various people talking, and he says, rightly or wrongly, that Jim Peniston was on the radio, which is that throws up another conundrum, because according to Jim Peniston, he had been given a 6-day leave after his involvement in the first night. But according, and this is not me that's talking, this is Steve Longero talking, he is on the radio saying, yeah, it's going over towards Rendlesham Forest or the forest. And he's kind of like tracking it from outside the weapon storage area. So that happens. And because then there is a panic that something is happening in the woods, basically, he has taken from the weapon storage area, because he's just new on shift, he's actually an extra person. Ordinarily, he wouldn't have been removed from the weapon storage area. But he said, because they wanted people in the forest and they just needed bodies, for want of a better expression, he found himself being taken from the weapon storage area, which is highly unusual, then being taken with others to the forest. And imagine that if there's a developing incident that's just unfolding, as it were, there's going to be a lot of panic. And I think there was real consternation, something really strange going on. And so they wanted, I guess, as many personnel into the forest because they didn't know what was going to develop. And he was one of those. And he said he was taken from the site, driven over to the forest to what is called now, or referred to as, the staging area. The staging area was an area inside Rendlesham Forest where basically at that time you couldn't go any further. You could follow a track, a path into the forest, and then you came to a bit of a dead end, and that's where all the vehicles would stop and people would deploy from there. So it's now being called the staging area. Popularly called the stage area. Couldn't go any further, you couldn't drive any further, so you had to get out and go on foot. Well, he says then he was taken with maybe 10, 15 others to what was the scene of the first night landing, if you remember. So we're not quite sure, but it indicates it's either a third or fourth night. We're not quite sure. But the point is, his recollection is clear of the event. And this is what is important for me, not so much the date and time. It's really about getting his account, and it's ingrained into his memory. So he's saying that he is taken out to the forest, they get out of the staging area, and then he is effectively taken with a group of 10 to 15 others to the site of the first, what we refer to as the first night landing, the one involving Jim Peniston and John Burroughs. And it's whilst there that they then have another UFO sighting. So he has a second UFO sighting. So this is a completely new event. So yes, there've been rumors of beams being shot down into a weapon storage area, but this now is in a completely new. So when he's telling me this, I'm thinking, wow, I've never heard this. So it's exciting for me as an interviewer and researcher into the case. So he's describing an entirely new event, and it's a new event because this occurred before any senior officers turned up, and this is what he says then. So after they've had a UFO sighting of a sphere whizzing around the sky, then senior military officers turn up, including, I believe, Colonel Holt and others. But they are then briefed by Jim Peniston, which again is something I've never heard Jim talk about, but this is Steve Longero's account. Why should he lie? So this is his account, and basically, that is his involvement. So he has one major incident on the weapon storage area. The object goes over to the forest. They're needing people to go to a basically unknown situation, a developing situation, and he's taken from the WSA, driven over along with many others. And I think, in fact, if I remember correctly, when he is after the sighting and Holt turns up. He is then told to go back to the staging area where Colonel Holt then briefs all the security, US Air Force security personnel at the staging area. Now, here's an interesting thing. He would say that when he's getting briefed at the staging area by Colonel Holt, i.e., you go off and go get more LITOs, which is what he was told to do, go with others, go get more LITOs because they wanted to illuminate the forest. Or try to. He said at the time he's at the staging area being briefed by Colonel Holt, guess who's there? Who we recognize? He said, I recognize Larry Warren was there. Okay, so this is interesting because lots of people have tried to write Larry Warren out of this. Do you know Larry Warren? He says, well, my son was on the same training space. I said, what? Oh, yeah, I'm in the same. Intake photographs at Lackland Air Force. And sure enough, he produced me the photograph, and there. Two or three rows apart, there they are. And they'd been in a group of maybe 45 people who were in the intake. And I can kind of vouch for this system myself because that's what happened to me or anybody who joins the military. You do your basic training, and then you often go off to do your what's called your trade training, whatever type of trade you were going to do in the forces. So in my case, I did a basic 6 week training at RAF Swinderby that everybody has to do joining the Royal Air Force at that time. And then you went off because I was going to be an RAF policeman. And I then went away to RAF Newton near Nottingham in the UK, Nottinghamshire, and did, I think, 12 weeks there doing my police trade training. So like 18 weeks in total. Well, he had been on the same, he'd not been on probably the basic course. But when they got to our Lackland Air Force Base, this was basically security police officers all doing training together. And in that group of 45, as I can attest to, you wouldn't know all of them, but you'd know the name because you were marching with them, you were doing all your classes with them. You'd know that they were on your flight or flight, as it was called in the area. And so they were in your intake. So when you did group photographs, you knew that he was part of that. So you may have a passing hello, how are you, or whatever, but you tended to just stick with a small group of people, those that lived closest to you in the dormitory or blocks, where you were sleeping. You tended to maybe hook up with five or six people who you were around you, and you became close to them. But you would know every one of the others. You might not know them really very well, but you'd know them in passing enough to say hello. Well, when he said that to me, and subsequently I saw the photographs, I thought, what a brilliant memory trigger to confirm that someone was there. And the reason why he was pleased to see Larry Warren is because he's thinking, what the hell am I getting mixed up in? And what is going on? And he looked, saw Larry Warren at the staging area and went, oh, I'm glad to recognize somebody who's like me, new to this space, and what the hell is going on? So he was kind of like had that kinship with somebody who'd been on the same train and found themselves in exactly the same position, i.e., you've only just come on the base and then you're caught up in these weird and wonderful events, as the they were transpiring. So that for me as a former detective is a brilliant recognition memory trigger for him to remember that specific. But according to the likes of Holt, he was never there. Or if he was there, he was in the background. Well, not there according to Steve Longero, because he's there front and center with all the others in the staging area. So that's a very interesting aside. So that's Steve Longero, and he came out. But the key of all the things that I came up with over my research of the 5 years, the most important person I think I've ever spoken to and had the privilege of interviewing was a guy called Adrian Bastinza, who was a sergeant at the time of the incident, Sergeant Adrian Bastinza. But somebody who had been highly traumatized by the incident, like many others had, but he had been particularly affected, found it very difficult to deal with. And there are reasons why that is difficult for him. And he had made various kind of like online comments and various, had done one or two interviews over the years, but never really been a public face of the story. But it had been actually someone who had quietly been what I call a linking person. And for me, he's arguably the most important person in the entire RFI. Why? Because he is that linking character. And what he linked with was an alleged second London. Now, if you remember, there's been all this hoo-ha in recent years, and certainly Holt had tried to minimize Larry Warren's involvement for many years, putting him down, calling him a wannabe, and whatever. So there's all these things, and of course, people now, with the rise of social media, they don't really do research like they should. They'll just go onto a website and say, "Well, that's a powerful person. I like that. I like their account." They don't, often people don't do the real groundwork themselves. They just are drawn to personalities, and some powerful personalities can get followers, and that's the nature of Facebook, social media, by the by. But suffice to say that Adrian Bastinza had made many comments saying that Larry Warren had been present in what was a second London. Now, let's put this into context. Larry Warren had been the first military whistleblower to go on the record. And what I mean by that was he was the first person to use his real name and go on camera under the name of Larry Warren. Originally, it was a pseudonym of Art Wallace, which was given to him by a guy called Larry Fawcett, who'd been a Connecticut detective. And that was when he was first came to know in late 1982. He spoke to Larry Fawcett. And they used his basic testimony as a chapter in their very good book, Clear Intent, written with Barry Greenwood, which contained this new case, Reynolds from Forest, or as it was probably called, the Bentmore's case at that point. So that was that. And the story kind of like he was out there saying that he'd seen entities when he eventually went on CNN and things like that, early 85. The CNN special, he's the only one on camera saying, "My name's Larry Warren, and I saw some kind of entity, some kind of life force," however you want to describe it. And it was literally, he was the only one talking to the press until about 1991, which is when you had the retirements of the like of Colonel Holt, and then followed quickly by the likes of John Burroughs. He retired in the early 90s, that the narrative then changed, because then they all said collectively, "Well, we don't understand your account, it doesn't tally with our recollections, and therefore it's a big question mark." So they then became the prominent people, and became prominent because they'd been effectively named or could be attributed to the Holt memorandum. If you remember in early 1983, the memorandum surfaced. It was a document that should never have been released. Colonel Holt tried to stop it coming out publicly, but it was too late. A copy had already been sent to various researchers in the US, who then passed it to British UFO researchers. And then, through a series of negotiations, that document then featured in this big News of the World a British tabloid headline on the 2nd of October 1983, UFO lands in Suffolk, it's official. That's the big headline. And that's when the case really hit the world media. It was known a little bit through UFO circles, one or two articles prior to that, but it was when it hit the major world story, it was when in that big tabloid splash. And that produced part of the Holt Memorandum. And so there's this US Air Force document that basically written by Lieutenant Colonel Holt, the deputy base commander, and he basically said in the three paragraphs, first paragraph, there's been a landing on what was deemed the first night of the incident, which is the Jim Pennis and John Burroughs event, a landed small triangular craft. And then 2 nights later, he'd gone out into the forest with others, including Sergeant Adrian Bastinza, I might add, was one of his small group. And they too had seen multiple UFOs, and he put his name to that document. And that's, in a sense, when it hit the world as a major case. So you've got that. And that kind of then superseded anything that had come before. And so Larry Warren's account then was kind of criticized by the likes of Holt, Pennis, and Burroughs. It didn't match what their testimony was. So it was like put up as, well, it's a standalone. Now, in reality, over the years, it was never a standalone because there was a guy called Greg Bateran, who was a friend of Warren's and was in the US Air Force Security Police as well. And he'd been interviewed by this Connecticut police officer in 1984. And it's an interview that's out there. It's included in the book. And it's been out there in various books. And he basically said that he'd been out with three others on a particular night of the events, not sure the date, but they come across a strange yellow green mist on the ground that seemed to hug the ground. And then especially if you watch the CNN documentary that aired with Chuck DeCaro in early 85, they did, and you can get it on the internet, and I put the links in the book. It's a really good documentary because it kind of does, a graphic artist has done some drawings based on what the witnesses were saying. And in relation to this guy, Greg Bateran, they do these drawings that show like a craft on the ground, lights, mist, he describes mist, and then they get close to it, he and three others. They then get spooked to the extent that they run away terrified and they run back towards the staging area. And this is when he says something interesting. He says, as I'm running to the staging area, I see a number of people, including Holt, and also I believe Larry Warren was arriving. Now, he knew with him. He was one of, so he would recognize somebody who was a mate. So you've got that reference there. And then if we've talked about Steve Longero coming with his extra testimony saying, I was on the same training course, I saw him at the staging area. So that's two people putting him there. So there's two links. But the key person in all of this, and in fact, I think arguably the most important witness, and I've said this in the book, I'll tell you for why. Because Adrian Bastinza had been a part of the small team that Holt talked about going into the forest on his night, which the team now popularly referred to as the Holt night and regarded as the third night of activity, i.e. the first night being 25th of December into the 26th, second night being the Lieutenant Bonnie Tamplin, and we'll come back to that in the second part of the show, and what happened to her, which it's amazing. That's an incredible tale on its own. We never knew that until this research has come out. So we'll come back to her. So that was the 26th into the 27th, Bonnie Tamplin. And then the third night, popularly called the Holt night, is the 27th into the 28th. And then there is some speculation based on this new testimony by Adrian Bastinza that there's a fourth consecutive night, which is the 28th and 29th. Now, it's an interesting thing that originally, when the memorandum comes out, the dates are, as I've just described. The first night was supposedly the 26th into the 27th, according to the memo. And then 2 nights later, it would have been the 28th into the 29th. Those dates got changed, supposedly by mistake. Quite how that happened, I find amazing that they did. But based on largely the Suffolk police records, the first night is now accepted as the 25th into the 26th because of the way police officers deploy and there are times and dates. But let's go back to Adrian Bastinza. So Adrian Bastinza was part of this small team that Holt, according to the memorandum, that Holt led out into the forest. And of course, we have the audio tape that he took, which is basically 18 minutes of a 4.5 hour experience as they trample through the woods, seeing various things before returning to the staging area and going back to the bases. So think about that. Now, when I first met Holt in December of 2007, there as to be on the as part of what was an episode of the UFO Hunters TV series with Bill Burnt. And so I met Holt for the first time. We'd spent some time together. We got on really well. We just hit it off, and it was great. And for me, very privileged to be talking with Colonel Holt at that time. And so anyway, we developed a collaboration to work. I'd asked him by the end of that film shoot over 3 days, would he collaborate with me on developing a potential film script? Because my first passion in life has always been cinema. And I always had felt that the Rendlesham Forest case, whether I was involved or not, was destined one day to be a feature film because it's such a good story that it needed to be told, but it's very difficult because there's so many people involved. So anyway, he'd agreed to do that. But the existing story, as per the memo, is that Holt takes a team out into the forest and they go off for 4.5 hours. And Bustinza is one of those. We know that because Bustinza is actually can be heard on the audio tape and referenced 3 times in the transcript of the audio tape that Holt made. But here's the interesting thing. When I first met Holt, I said, I'm going to go away, study as much as I can, and then come back to you and start asking you questions. He said, yeah, fair enough. So 4 months later, I did that and started asking him a question. I said, who's the fifth person? He said, oh, no, I'm not quite sure. And I'm thinking, well, he could name the others just like that without even a pause for thought. But the fifth one, I'm not sure. And he was kind of like reluctant. And I said, it's Adrian Bastinza. And I said, it's Adrian Bastinza because he's on the audio tape and he's referenced. Adrian Bastinza. See, but it was like he gave me the impression that he didn't want to talk about Adrian Bastinza. And for a long time, I thought, why don't you want to talk about Adrian Bastinza? And I think now the answer is with that collaboration period over, which is another story, but suffice to say that I now think that the reason why he was reluctant to talk about Adrian Bastinza because Adrian Bastinza talked about another landing, not the Jim Penniston landing, another landed craft. And he talked about it in early interviews, but these have never really gained any traction other than really within UFO journals and within the subject itself. Never really attracted any media attention out of UFO circles. And you think, well, why is he reluctant? And he's reluctant because Colonel Holt had always denied that there'd been any other landing because the other landing referred to aliens and entities. And this is on the Will Harrop Warren. And of course, we can't have aliens. And they were very, very quick within days of the incident to say, oh, well, there's no aliens involved. And often it's a good ploy to hide in plain sight. So he put it down straight away and said, oh, now that, yeah, there was an incident, but there's no aliens. And they just kept saying, no aliens. No aliens. They don't want to talk about this. Now, when that, you had this situation where nobody really wanted to talk about Bustinza's account. Because Bustinza's account, which had been out there for a long time, but had never really been developed or he'd never been re-interviewed and questioned by somebody who was a, like, I was an experienced advanced interviewer of suspects and witnesses. So I was training to use different methods to elicit more information. Nobody had ever done that to him. And yet I began to realize that Adrian Bastinza may be the key to a very part of the story. So, cutting a long story short, Bastinza had always said that he was referring to a different kind of landing. And he'd said over the years that Larry Warren was with him in the field, and but nobody really talked about that because it didn't fit the existing narrative of Holt, Penniston, Burroughs. That was all neatly put up, could be referenced. They were linked to the memo, which indicated 2 events: the first night and then another event 2 nights later, which was the whole night. So it never really gained traction, but he'd made these interviews. And then I tried over the years to search for Adrian Bostinza. I found him on social media, but he didn't want to interview me. And then eventually, through somebody else who was plays an important part, Laurie Rehfeldt, who was on the base but moved, that left the base just before the main incident. In December, early December, she left 1980, just before the main incidents. But she'd already had a sighting of her own and a number of weird experiences that she'll quite happily talk about. But she's referenced in the book of having what's called a precursor event, i.e., several incidents throughout 1980 that were building up to this, in a sense, crescendo of events at the late December. So she goes off the base just before, but she knew all, many of the people. And it was through her that she said, "I've spoken to Adrian, he's now willing to speak to me." Wow. So this was like totally unexpected. And cutting a long story short, all of this was arranged and then it didn't happen. There was mix up in dates and times and it didn't happen for a couple of occasions. But eventually it happened and I rang him from my home. I ended up having what turns out to be a 4.5 hour transatlantic mobile phone call that cost me £180. But it was the best £180 I've ever spent because this guy who I thought had more information, and I'm finally talking to him. So it was wow. It was like a wow moment for me. I finally got all this guy, and would you be willing to, go with the interview techniques that I'm going to try? And he went, yeah, okay. And it turned out 4.5 hours right through the night for me. So it was like 1 in the morning when I finally make up, and we talked for 4.5 hours all through the night. And when you're an interviewer and you're doing it in the way that I was doing it, very tiring mentally. To concentrate because you're thinking of the next question, you're reacting to what the person is saying, etc. But anyway, cutting a long story short, that interview was a revelation because he then said, in only the last hour of the interview, so we're into the fourth hour, as it were, he then says, "Yeah, Larry Warren was involved, but it was on another night." And I went, "What do you mean another night?" He said, "That was another night of UFO activity, in essence." I said, well, what do you mean? He said, "It wasn't the same night as the Holt night." I went, "What?" And so he was alluding to a completely different event that was separate from the Holt night. It was on another night, according to Adrian Bostinza. And it's his account. It's not my account. It's his account. And so that was a revelation. And basically what he said was in this second event, and he believed it was a second consecutive night, which we're now thinking maybe a fourth night, consecutive night. He said that he was involved in a second event, and that second event involved Larry Warren. And he said, "This is the field incident he's talking to." So if you can think about it, it helps explain some of the confusion if his memory is accurate. We're not quite sure, but it kind of makes sense in one sense. That it takes it away from the whole night. People said, "No, I don't remember that." Well, it's another night, according to Adrian Bostinza. This is a new revelation. And what he's basically saying is that, yeah, actually, Larry Warren is with other security police officers around what had been a mist. And then there's been this second land of translucent craft. And he basically said that Larry Warren was within feet of it. And he said that at one point, Larry Warren moved towards it. Ahead of him, and he was only like 20, 30 feet away from this thing, and Larry Warren was 10 feet closer to it, so in front of him. So he very, to me personally, he was saying Larry Warren's there, and I don't know why they chose him, but he went forward towards it. Now, this is the same incident that Warren had said, and he describes it almost the same. Security police officers surrounding this landed craft, and whilst he doesn't go down the line of saying he saw entities as described by in the detail that Larry Warren described, he does admit to seeing silhouettes of some kind of life force in association with this craft. And that was still going on as Warren is tapped out, as it were, and told to go back to the staging area. Bostinza will still remain there. So, from Bostinza's point of view, this is incredible testimony of a what turns out to be another night, another consecutive night, and that Warren was in there. So again, this is direct testimony. Now, this is the same incident where Warren had said that it was being filmed on, he said, City Film and early video. When you talked to Adrian Bastinger, he said, yeah, it's being filmed. Motion picture footage, i.e., some kind of moving. And he also said that Colonel Williams was there. Now, Colonel Williams is the base commander of 12,000 people. Holt has always denied, absolutely denied, that there'd never been aliens. It was all a load of rubbish. And that Colonel Williams had not been involved. But here is now two people corroborating each other, very, very similar accounts. And I'm hearing this as direct testimony of somebody who was there. It's not hearsay, it's his account saying, I'm in the field. Warren is closer to the object than I was. It's another night, and that it was being filmed. There are other security police officers, and that Colonel Williams is involved. Wow. So it's corroboration to this original Warren account that's been sort of vilified over the years. But now, if you think about it, that's now three people: Bustinza, Steve Longero, two people I've talked to directly who say Warren was involved. And then you have this historical account from Greg Batram, who said, I saw Warren as I was running out towards the stage, and he's just arriving. So that's three people. So as far as I'm concerned, that's done and dusted now. Evidentially, three people corroborating another person's account is effectively pretty good. And so I think that's done and dusted now. There should be no ambiguity anymore because of Adrian Bastinza. But it throws up massive conundrum because Holt was always denied that there was a second landing, always said that the Warren's account was fanciful, no aliens, nothing like that, no entities. And of course, people have denied that any footage was taken, movie footage. Well, I think in the second part of the show, I'm going to tell you how that links into even more evidence to say that that event did happen, was filmed, and Holt knew about it.
Well, that's a great lead-in, Gary. And I'm telling you, you had me on the edge of my seat. Adrian Bastinza, the linchpin between the two, clearly a line of delineation. What happened in the forest with Holt happened in the forest, and then what happened later with Warren, backed up Bertram, backed up by Longero. This is fantastic stuff. And folks, we're just getting started. Can you let our listeners know how they can find your book and your website, Gary?
Yeah, the book is out on Amazon. It's self-published through the Amazon, so you can get it in pretty much any country that you want on Amazon. It's called Non-Human, The Rendlesham Forest UFO Incident. I put an S on because it's referred to generally as the Rendlesham Forest Incident, but my book concludes that there were at least 17 different incidents involving UFOs as part of that 3 4 day period. So I think that was a better title. And the subline is, the tagline is 42 years of denial, because I think it's been covered up by both the British government and the US government, the Ministry of Defence for the UK, and the military intelligence from America. So that's why it's 42 years of denial. And the press, we'll talk about the press probably later, but the press have played a big key role in dumbing down this case and trying to stop people really asserting the importance of the case as it should have been.
And for our dear listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.